This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus. Hello and welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and today we're speaking with a return guest, David Hanscom. He is a medical doctor, he is a spine surgeon, and he's the author of Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. Welcome to the show, David.
Yeah, thanks. I'm excited to be back.
Thanks for being with us. So just for people who might not have heard your previous interviews, you have kind of were an overachiever all of your life in academics and athletics and just pushing yourself, go, 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 go. And that at a certain point, you started having panic attacks.
Right. What I didn't realize is that I came from a very abusive background. I had a mother who's basically psychotic, very abusive. She also had chronic pain herself. And that's one of the reasons I become so focused on the family aspect of chronic pain, because chronic pain has a terrible, terrible impact on the family. So at about age 15 years old, I sort of shut the door on my past life and started moving forward, creating my new life. And I did it. I was athletic, I was smart, I was personable, all these things that you're supposed to do. But I didn't understand that anxiety and anger were the basis of my behavior, because that was normal to me. I actually didn't even know what anxiety was until I was driving across a bridge in Seattle at about 10 o'clock, and I went from having essentially no anxiety to having panic attacks.
Wow.
What I didn't realize, and that started a 15-year tailspin into the worst experience I can imagine of chronic pain. So what happened is that the way I became such an accomplished surgeon is I suppressed anxiety. I wasn't connected to it at all. But what happens is your body doesn't believe you. So what was happening, which I didn't realize, I was developing all sorts of physical symptoms. And when you suppress anxiety, your body's still full of stress chemicals. So even though you consciously can't feel it, your body is still reacting. So it's full of cortisol, adrenaline, histamines, all sorts of stress chemical drugs. And what happens is that translates into physical symptoms. So what happened to me, I had 16 of these potential 30 symptoms all at the same time. So I was having migraine headaches, my feet were burning, my ears were ringing, I had neck pain, back pain, stomach issues, I couldn't sleep, developed extreme anxiety, developed a full-blown depression for about 10 years, and I actually evolved into what's called an obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is really an extreme anxiety disorder marked by repetitive intrusive thoughts. And I was having all these symptoms at the same time, and I had no idea what was going on. Then when I was hit with the panic attacks around 1990, I was just blown away. I didn't know what to do. So that's how this whole book evolved, was really diving into this whole chronic pain experience without any warning. And when I came out of it in 2003, I didn't know how I got into it. I didn't know how I came out of it. And tell me about the last 8 years of lots of reading experience and watching my patients get better. Have I somewhat figured out the way to get out of this problem?
Thanks, David. And today we're going to be talking about the family connection with regards to chronic pain. And it's interesting what you said about how, number one, you didn't realize that you were living in an abusive environment as a child,
right,
and a young person. And when the anxiety came, or before it developed into full-blown anxiety attacks, you apparently had been having anxiety for many, many years, but you weren't aware of it.
Right.
And I think that that's really common for a lot of people, that connection between not realizing that you came from an abusive environment, so that chronic anxiety, it's just normal.
Right. It's an odd thing to try to describe, because looking back at my life, when I was in 7th and 8th grade, I started to stutter, which obviously is anxiety. And it didn't really get better until college and medical school for a long time. So it's interesting, I was extremely successful in suppressing the feeling of anxiety. So I didn't feel anxious, I just stuttered. Or, you know, I didn't feel anxious, I just had extreme migraine headaches. Here's what's different than I talked to you last. So what's happened the last couple of years is that a friend of mine started reading neuroscience research as a hobby. And I think he downloaded something like 11,000 articles on neuroscience.
Wow.
And probably read close to 1,000 of them. Then he had me read probably 100 or so. Plus, he just taught me a lot about neuroscience. It turns out that anxiety is simply a survival reflex that protects you from danger. So every living creature has anxiety to protect them, and the creatures who ignored the cues, of course, didn't survive. So it turns out that the most anxious species are the ones that survived. So what happens, you have a physical threat, whether you're a mammal, fish, or whatever it is, you have a physical threat. Your body perceives a threat, secretes cortisol, adrenaline, histamines, and other stress chemicals. Then you have this chemical surge, and then you feel anxious. So all anxiety is that feeling generated by this massive chemical response. So most of, essentially all of our human behavior is directed by avoiding that feeling of anxiety. Anxiety is, the reason why it's so critical to understand is the essence of the treatment is that anxiety is a survival reflex. It's part of the unconscious automatic response. It's a million times stronger than the conscious brain. It's a 1,000,000-to-1 ratio. So if you try to treat this psychologically, it's a disaster. It can't work, and it doesn't work. Humans have an additional problem is that thoughts create the same chemical reaction in your body as a physical threat. In other words, a mental threat, an unpleasant thought, goes to the similar part of the brain. It creates the same chemical reaction, and then you feel anxious. The problem that humans have compared to other living creatures is that you can't escape your thoughts, right? I mean, you can suppress them, which I did. You can experience them, which all of us do that too. Then another common mechanism, probably the rule, is masking them, some type of addiction or workaholic or getting busy, et cetera. And that works to some degree, but of course, in the big picture, the anxiety always wins. You know, a lot of people use achievement and possessions and money and power to deal with anxiety. And we all know the high profile suicides, et cetera, et cetera. So it turns out that this unconscious brain is so powerful that you can't outrun your thoughts with mental tools or even physical tools. So right now, it's really, really critical to understand that anxiety is simply a chemical reaction and it's not psychological. It's clear that anxiety actually is the pain. In other words, you have an uncomfortable sensation that's hot or cold or painful, but unless it creates a certain threshold effect where you actually feel that chemical surge to create anxiety, you don't take action, right? So that's the deal, is that this really the model that medicine has missed badly, is that the neuroscience research has actually showed us the cure for chronic pain, but essentially none of that knowledge has actually penetrated mainstream medical thinking.
Well, we could have two or three shows about that, because I know that someone right now who's dying from advanced diabetes, and yet in the hospital they're being fed sugar.
Wow.
Like the white potatoes and canned peaches and things like that. I was like, how is this
really
protocol for diabetes? But anyway, so we could talk all day about the delays in Western medicine picking up with the latest research. So today we're talking about the family, and one of the biggest things, I mean, if on your website, backincontrol.com, you have information about the book, and you also have your blog that goes over the four stages of recovering from chronic pain. And the first stage is part of where you get the family involved. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Right. So going back to the conversation about the source of anxiety, is that anytime you're anxious or frustrated, you're being what's called triggered. In other words, something threatened you, either mentally or physically, and your body triggered a survival response. It turns out the way humans evolved is by connecting to other human beings. And we know that human connection is a very basic need. The deeper the connection, the better. But the deeper the connection, the deeper the triggers. In other words, families trigger each other. It's 100%, and we're finding out whether you're a billionaire or living on the street, it doesn't really matter. Relationships are complicated, and so it's very paradoxical in the human experience that the deepest connections, which is one of our basic human needs, is also our biggest trigger that creates all sorts of mayhem in the family. So it turns out what disrupts families is a neurological trick. It's not rational, and that's why we've developed some arbitrary rules around a family and chronic pain. But also turns out that chronic pain is just devastating to families. Devastating. because let's say I'm the person with chronic pain, and I come home and I've had a bad day with my boss, or the doctor told me something I didn't like, or I'm a disability and the claims examiner gives me a hard time, which is also very common. I walk in the door and I'm angry. Well, if you're a 6-year-old and a 10-year-old and a spouse waiting for you to come home, what do you see? You see this beast coming to the door who's angry. Then there's a process called mirror neurons that the body, your brain mirrors what it sees. That's how you learn. For instance, when you smile at a baby, when the baby smiles back, it's not because the baby's happy. It's simply imitating your smile. It's called mirror neurons. So when you walk in the house and you're angry, you've actually stimulated that negative part of your family's brain. So instead of your family being excited to see you, you just actually stimulated a negative part of their brain. So they may have had a great day, and you walk in and just throw a damper on the situation, unconsciously, of course. And then when you're in chronic pain and trapped and angry and upset, while you really can't see the needs of the people around you very clearly, and so it's ironic is that your family, who is your closest connections, now becomes a target for your anger. And I'll never forget a physical therapist years ago telling me about, and I wish I could have kept the piece that she wrote me. It's about two paragraphs. But she's telling me about this idyllic life in New York, family trips to Coney Island, just a really wonderful life. Then when she's about 12 years old, her father lost his job. And it's like in one day, it's like you open the door and this huge fog rolled into the house, and it was never the same ever. It was anger, it was frustration. The parents split up. The kids really had a lot of trouble. So when you get anger in the household on a regular basis, especially, it's a disaster. It's horrible for everybody. And probably one of the main reasons that a big part of our country is dealing with what's called adverse childhood experiences is called the ACE score. And there's a major study done out of San Diego about 15 years ago that looked simply, they looked at 10 variables that existed in the family. And there's things like emotional, physical, or sexual abuse, a parent with mental health issues, parent in prison, et cetera. So there's all these negative things that were existing in the household. And the first thing I found out that was surprising, that only 30% of kids had an A score of 0, and 36% of the kids had an A score of 3 or more. And they found out with an A score of 3 or more that you had higher instance of suicide, depression, obesity, coronary artery disease, and one other, hypertension, eating disorders. I mean, the list went on and on and on, and it was consistent. If you had an A score of 3 or more, you got sick, and you didn't take care of yourself. So chronic pain is deadly because people in chronic pain are trapped. When you're trapped by anything, you become angry, whether it's finances, relationship, or pain, or whatever. So when people in chronic pain are angry, they really it devastates everybody, including the patient, but especially their family. It's a devastating problem. So what happens is that if you're my patient, you walk in the office, and you've had chronic pain for whatever period of time it is. So going on back to the original basis of pain, which is simply that chemical reaction. So we think in terms of pain pathways, that with repetition, your pain becomes memorized in about 6 to 12 months. So once you have this pathway or set of circuits in your brain that's memorized, they are permanent. It's like riding a bicycle. And the more you try to fix them and solve them, the worse it gets. So the solution to chronic pain lies in two things. One of them is decreasing the body's stress chemicals. There's a bunch of ways of doing that. And the second thing is called neuroplasticity, where actually train your brain to have a different reaction to stress. So instead of being stressed with an automatic survival response of adrenaline and cortisol, it becomes stress, a little bit of a space, and then choice of reaction. As you start making a more positive choice, while your brain actually starts to physically change. So one thing that we realized in some of these workshops that we've done is that people in chronic pain talk about their pain all the time. Mm-hmm. So between discussing the pain with their friends and family and actually trying to find a solution for their pain, it probably occupies anywhere from 50 to 80% of their conscious hours. And their poor family is absolutely tortured because they're connected to this person. They don't like to see that person suffer. But when the person complains, it's also very frustrating because there's nothing that they can do. So we get to go into the mirror neurons model, where you have a person who's angry, frustrated. Now they're discussing their pain all the time. And so instead of having a household of peace, love, joy, and creativity, it just turns dark. Mm-hmm. And there's one headline a few weeks ago that pointed out that 34 million American children are exposed to toxic stress in the household. That's a lot of people. I don't know what percent of those people are in chronic pain that are exposing their families to toxic stress, but I suspect it's a lot. So if you're in my office, say, look, there's four things you're going to do when you leave this office. First of all, I'm going to ask that each person in the family that's an adult or teenager participate in this process of healing. We call it the DOC Project, Direct Your Own Care. And between the book and the website, it's about a 90% self-directed process. Number two, you will never discuss your pain ever again, except with your healthcare providers, ever. And it's fascinating because I had no idea until I started implementing that rule how much people talked about their pain. And they literally look at me and go, well, what do I talk about? Oh. Well, remember, if you look in terms of neuroplasticity, in other words, you can't control your brain, you can't control the survival response, but you can direct it. So you can actually direct your brain to develop any way you want it to. Your brain changes every millisecond. With neuroplasticity, your brain's changing connections, growing cells, loosening cells every second. So if you're 80% of your waking hours are spent thinking about the pain, that's where your brain's going to develop. So that rule has been very powerful. The third thing I ask people to do is on the car ride home or on a date, spend at least an hour remembering when things were really fun. When was the most enjoyable time of your relationship? And remember in detail. And so it's interesting, a lot of people have been so angry and separated for so long, they actually have a hard time doing that. They can hardly remember when things were fun. And then the final aspect is there's a whole section on my website about rules of anger in the family, with the basic concept being you're going to create a safe house. So your physical space that you call home is going to be absolutely safe. So if you become triggered by your child or your spouse or partner, that you make an absolute agreement to just stop. Because remember, anxiety and anger are part of the unconscious brain. It's a million times stronger than the conscious brain. And I don't know if you've noticed, but I get to struggle like everybody else, is that when you're arguing, nothing ever gets solved, right? Mm-hmm. So we just say stop. It's like two boxers in a ring that are clutching each other. You just have to break it up. So my point is, if you are triggered and anxious and frustrated, the person who is not triggered, in other words, a person who is relatively sane at the moment, simply has to walk out of the room. And it's hard. I mean, it still feels like the person that triggered you is the one that's making you angry. But in the big picture, it's the only thing that works, because nothing gets solved in an argument. They're the reactive survival patterns. And so if you need to get into an argument, take it outside. So those four initial steps have been absolutely unbelievable in solving the problem as far as pain. So it turns out these triggers are so deep that when somebody's triggered, the pain reliably goes up. It turns out that these family triggers are the trump cards. We do all these medical treatments, but unless we address these family triggers on a regular basis, nothing else works. Conversely, if you can create these rules around anger within the family, the ascent out of chronic pain is unbelievable sometimes. It's really remarkable how if you flip that switch, how people can come out of chronic pain very quickly.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Mm-hmm. my eyes. The last Sunday of every month from 11 to 5. I want you here with me.
Right now, we are speaking with David Hanscom. He is the author of Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. And we're talking a little bit about the family dynamic. And I'm wondering, because in the family, in the home, it's supposed to be your refuge from the world. So I see how there's massive problem if you're walking in the door angry and kids are kind of... you know, awaiting when you're going to get home, whether you'll be in a good mood or bad mood, and that uncertainty and all of that anxiety associated with it. But what about, how do we deal with people out in the world who are constantly talking, like if we're at work or at the coffee shop or wherever, who are constantly talking about their anger, their pain, their negativity, their depression? How do we protect ourselves because of those mirror neurons and the neurons that fire when we have a thought? How do we protect ourselves from that?
So you don't. And okay. So what you do, there's a website post I wrote called The Ring of Fire. And what it is, it's three rings, the outside ring being blue, the middle ring being red, and the inner ring being green. And the outer ring, the blue ring, is what we do to make ourselves happy in life. In other words, you know, activities, accomplishments, whatever we want to do, achievements to make ourselves feel happy. Then the red ring is the anger, frustration, and fear, which we all want to avoid. And then the green ring is the center of just being who we are. So like we talked about earlier in the program, we spend most of our conscious energy staying out of the red ring, avoiding fear and anxiety. So we're obsessively busy doing what we do to stay out of the red ring, suppressing, et cetera. And we're pretty successful for a long time until we're not. So what happened to me, I was in the blue ring, overachiever, great life, had the best time you can imagine, and it was great. But I couldn't outrun my mind. So I started to descend into the red ring of fear and anxiety, and I couldn't get out of it. And the reason I ended up in the middle in the green, because I just got stripped down. There was nothing left. So it turns out that the essence of the solution to chronic pain is becoming comfortable with uncomfortable sensations. Hmm. In other words, as you quit fighting fear and anxiety and learn to be with it, then it starts to atrophy. Is then going back to the family scenario, as you start diffusing the negative energy, you have family meetings where you start organizing your time. What can we do to have fun again? How can we organize family activities? How can we rationally solve family issues, etc.? So what happens once you can diffuse this horrendous negative energy and start becoming creative, things start to change. So with this ring of fire, as you quit fighting the negatives, which of course gives it a lot of power, those circuits start to atrophy. And as you learn just to be with the pain and be with the anxiety and be with the anger, in other words, you don't want to get rid of anxiety and anger because you die. You have to have anxiety and anger to survive. So as you learn to be with those emotions, then your creativity starts coming back. So when your people at work are complaining and being negative, they are firing off your mirror neurons, but it's your opportunity to actually practice the skills of actually allowing yourself to be with negative emotions. Hmm. And pretty soon you start having compassion for people that are spending a lot of time talking about their pain and complaining, because when you're complaining, you're actually not having a very good time. You're not really enjoying life when you're complaining. So it turns out that you as you quit attaching your happiness to external circumstances, you become incredibly free. And every religion has the mystics that have said this for centuries, is that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. Well, the suffering comes from attachment. In other words, being attached to an outcome is when people suffer. Mm-hmm. So as you let go of outcomes and just get to be who you are, paradoxically, you actually have way more energy to accomplish what you want to accomplish. I know it's a long way of answering the question, but does that make sense? Did you follow all that?
I think so. It sounds like rather than, because I know when I'm around people who are really negative or who I find triggering in whatever way, my instinct is to try and avoid them as much as possible, right? To limit my exposure. It sounds like what you're saying is, I might not want to go out of my way to spend more time with this person, but if they're coming into the meeting in a bad mood and complaining about everything, I can just, rather than reacting to that and allowing myself to become angry and reactive, I can just maybe breathe and sit with that discomfort and not, acknowledge the discomfort without trying to push it away and without trying to fix it.
Correct. No, you're dead on. That's exactly the right answer. And again, all of us fail. I mean, I don't do this as well as I like to. So somebody comes in and they're angry and frustrated. Why it does trigger me, and this is the hardest part about the project, is you don't want to suppress the triggers. Mm-hmm. In other words, what got me in trouble in the first place as a kid was suppressing anxiety and suppressing anger. In fact, I thought I was pretty cool. I was actually a cauldron. I mean, I was so angry, I had no clue, but I wasn't connected to it. So allowing yourself to feel the emotion is really critical. Then training your brain not to react, that's where the action occurs. Because it's very stressful trying to avoid stress, right? I mean, life is stressful in general. New projects are stressful. Positive experiences are stressful. So the key issue is you just literally train yourself not to overreact to something that you perceived as unpleasant. And what's happening with me, again, I wish I could be way better than this. So I'm not trying to say that I have this figured out personally, but I've come a long ways, is that in an odd way that red ring starts to become somewhat narrower. So remember, you have to pass through the red ring either direction. In other words, you're in the blue ring, having a great time. You're trying to avoid fear and anxiety. And then, of course, you slip back into it, and then you can either fight it and go back into the blue ring or just be with it and allow yourself to be centered and in the middle. But if you're centered in the middle and you want to go out and say build a house or climb a mountain, that's stressful. So you have to pass through the red ring either way. So the red ring is simply part of your life. That's why I call it the ring of fire. And when I do my workshops, the first thing I say to my group is that you're not here to get rid of your pain. You're here to live your life, pain or no pain. And as you start living your life and moving forward, then paradoxically, those circuits start to atrophy and the pain really does go away.
Hmm. So thank you, David. I think there's there's a lot of new research about this. And I took a mindfulness-based stress reduction course a little while back, and which is great for chronic pain as well. And they say, like, a lot of people will go in with, of course, understandably, the goal of having less pain or having less anxiety. But if you go in with that being your focus, it actually doesn't work. But if you go in with just practicing with the attitude of, I'm just going to get better at practicing this, that's when the pain and anxiety start to decrease.
Right. I'm curious, how did it work for you? Sounds like it was a pretty positive experience.
It was really good. It definitely got me to a new level of understanding. The challenge is keeping up with the practice once you're out of that group that you're going to every week. Mm-hmm. But it has stuck with me and definitely got me to a new level of wellness.
So one thing to consider as a suggestion is that, do you remember my little thing called active meditation?
Yes.
So what happens, I'm trying to incorporate a little bit more of a meditation practice in my life, but I just don't have time to do that. I can't think of it very much. So what I do every day, I do what's called the expressive writing. I think we talked about that before. Mm-hmm. We simply write down your thoughts and tear them up. Did we discuss that before?
Absolutely, yes.
So I don't know if you noticed from the old book to the new book that most of the research has been done on negative writing, but the new book points out it can be any writing, positive or negative. And so that's not the solution, but it's always a starting point. And I call it mechanical meditation. In other words, you create an awareness of the thought, you separate it from the thought. So you can't control your thoughts, but you can separate. So the thought's a piece of paper, and the thought is there, you're here. There's a space that's now connected to vision and feel, which I think is part of the unconscious brain. So the reason that people tear up those thoughts immediately, and it could be any thoughts, positive or negative, rational or irrational, is that first of all, right with freedom. They're just thoughts. You're only trying to separate from them. But the second one is to not analyze them, because if you want to analyze them, then you're actually reinforcing them. My point being, you must put your hand right into a hornet's nest, because you're just trying to arrange something. You're trying to arrange these reactive survival patterns that's a million to one ratio, and you can't win. So for neuroplasticity, you do an awareness and separation, which already does in one step. And then even right now, as you're talking to me, just, you know, drop your shoulders for a second, take a little bit of a breath. And I call it active meditation, which simply puts your brain on a different sensation for 3 to 5 seconds. We actually do this all day long in surgery. If we're a little frustrated or anxious, we just drop our shoulders and go to feel. And as we're connected, you're now connected to a sensation instead of connected to these racing thoughts. And with repetition, it becomes almost automatic. And so it's been really, really a remarkable little tool.
Beautiful. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about the expressive writing for people who haven't heard about it. And I also was looking on your blog earlier, and you mentioned there's an article about the possibility of doing the expressive writing verbally.
Correct. So there's now almost, I'm actually going to talk to one of the original co-authors, but started in the 1980s, Dr. Pennebaker and Dr. Smythe started some research out of Austin, Texas, where they pointed out that writing down negative thoughts, they did a very succinct experiment of volunteers who spent 20 minutes for 4 days in a row writing about an intense emotional experience. And then 4 months later, they had less physical symptoms, better grade point average, less anxiety. It was unbelievable how much those 4 days made a difference, simply expressing that. But since then, there's been almost 1,000 research papers now that point out that any type of writing, whatever it is, somehow breaks up these circuits. So again, these mental circuits are the same as physical pain circuits. I call it a phantom brain pain. And it's somehow the writing exercises that somehow breaks up these circuits. So again, I do it once or twice a day, 5 or 10 minutes. I encourage people not to overwrite. You simply write down your thoughts, and you tear them up instantly, tear them, shred them, or burn them. And then to me, if you try to overwrite during the day to sort of capture these thoughts, while it's actually kind of productive because that's actually a form of control. So to me, they're writing sort of a metaphor for the day that these are just thoughts. You can also do it verbally. You simply go to a quiet room or in your car and verbalize these thoughts that are in your mind. And it really has about the same effect as the writing.
Would so you, sorry to interrupt you, David, would you record those verbal thoughts and listen to them back, or just say them?
Just say them. It's actually kind of productive to, it's kind of productive to reread them. It's kind of productive to record them and hear them back again, because they're just thoughts. And so you don't want to see, when you write these things down or say them, they seem like they're issues, but they're not. The only reality there is right this second is you and I talking, and I hope having a good time. I'm having a good time.
Me too.
And so, you know, that's the only reality there is. And all these other thoughts that come into our head aren't this reality. So what you're doing, you're just simply separating from these thoughts. And it's interesting because thoughts, people talk about, I mean, the power of thoughts are dramatic, because it turns out that this sustained mental pain is the bigger problem than the physical pain. Because again, first you can't escape it. But remember, those thoughts translate into a chemical reaction that creates physical symptoms. So I did write a website post called What's More Important, Your Physical Pain or Your Mental Pain? And it's actually the mental pain, because first of all, it disrupts your quality of life. But it also, again, you get the sustained chemical assault, and it translates into all these physical symptoms. Mm-hmm. There's a major study came out of Sweden just this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And they finally pointed out the link that a lot of us have suspected for a long time. But they looked at something like 900,000 patients or people that they rated their stress scores on. And they found out a significantly higher percent of autoimmune disorders in people with chronic stress.
Mm-hmm.
So we also know the lifespan of people in chronic pain is actually 7 years shorter than the average lifespan. There's two papers that document that the effect of chronic pain on a person's life is actually equivalent to terminal cancer. So, and then the medical profession says, well, we can't see it on a test, therefore it must be psychological, and it's not. It's a sustained neurochemical assault on your body that's not primarily psychological. So the reason why chronic pain right now is so devastating is that it's not being treated correctly on a regular basis. It's not very hard to treat once you understand the neurological nature of it. And the current definition of chronic pain in the from the neuroscientist is it is an embedded memory. The pain is an embedded memory that gets connected with more and more life events, and the memory can't be erased. So again, these are permanent pathways, permanent circuits. So what you're doing with these different tools is you're creating new pathways around the old pathways. And with repetition, your brain actually starts to physically change. Then, of course, what you do with your mindfulness meditation work is you've decreased the body's adrenaline. Remember, anxiety is the adrenaline. And so once you start decreasing the adrenaline, the anxiety starts to drop through the floor.
Thanks, David. So I have a couple of questions about that. With regards to the expressive writing, I'd love to talk a little bit more in detail about that for people who might still not be sure where to start, whether it's the writing or the speaking. So you just write whatever, like, I don't know what to write, so I'm starting, here I am, blah, 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 and just whatever comes out, you just record it.
Correct. And my nurse says 15 minutes twice a day. I think even a minute makes a difference. But yeah, if you do 5 or 10 minutes, once in the morning, once at night, the research also shows that the writing things down actually helps people fall asleep. So it's actually been one of the tools that we use to help people fall asleep. And so, yeah, it's free. It's flow of thought, flow of consciousness. And I can never read the writing. They're more or less just scribbles on a piece of paper. And I instantly tear it up and did my writing this morning. What I also find fascinating, you know, after 15 years of chronic pain, that simple writing exercise was the first thing in 15 years that I felt a shift. And within 2 weeks, my pain had dropped down some. By 6 weeks, my anxiety had dropped down something like 70%. I thought it was this book I'd read, but it actually, the book is a great book. It's Feeling Good by David Burns, but it's actually the writing that made the biggest difference. And then about 6 minutes later, when I somewhat accidentally and not very gracefully came across my own anger issues, is that my pain disappeared. Mm-hmm. So I've been pretty much pain-free for about 15 years, and I had an extreme experience for almost 15 years, which is a really long time to be in chronic pain. But yeah, the writing was the first thing after trying everything you can imagine that started to break up these circuits. So it's not the solution, but I will tell you, it's the one, I'll use the word mandatory, starting point to start the process. And again, 1,000 research papers, and by the way, a topic of a different podcast, is there's actually not one research paper that shows that back surgery works for back pain. But there's 1,000 research papers that shows that the expressive writing works.
David, I am curious. I'm kind of getting a little bit obsessive with this expressive writing thing here. Do you ever find that through your expressive writing, a great idea comes out? Like someone's, you know, my hesitancy not to record it if it was something verbal or the ripping it up is like, what if I come up with the cure for cancer in my rambling? I don't want to throw that away.
You have to throw it away. I mean, one of my pain colleagues who's extremely good at this point, a really quick observation is that if you decide to hold on to the writing, you're going to hold on to your pain. Mm. And I mean, it's other writing you can do. You can do creative writing, of course, and you can do analysis. But again, your brain's going to develop where it places attention. So as you write, as these issues come out and you decide to analyze them, your attention is actually reinforcing it. So instead of thinking in terms of psychology, think in terms of neuroplasticity, of stimulating neurological pathways to form, and they're going to form wherever you place your attention. So again, the writing does an awareness and separation. Then if your attention goes to just, you know, listening to sounds, tasting your food, enjoying the moment, that's where your brain's going to develop. Again, if you go back to analyzing the thoughts, that's where your brain's going to develop.
If you're one of the millions of Canadians who experience depression, anxiety, or some other form of mental illness, there's a free course that can help. The Wellness Recovery Action Plan is an evidence-based program that works. It's developed and facilitated by peers who have experienced their own mental health challenges and have used RAP to recover and maintain long-term stability. It's based on the key concepts of hope, personal responsibility, education, self-advocacy, and support. For more information about the free RAP groups hosted by Vancouver Coastal Health, visit their peer-led website, spotlightonmentalhealth.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is
an advertisement for
Finding the Funny
on CITR 101.9 Mondays 6 to 6:30. We'd love for you to tune in and check us out on Twitter at Finding Funny FM. Every week, host Nico McEwen talks about new comedy topics, whether it be stand-up, sketch comedy, TV comedy, and more, always playing some of the most hilarious bits.
With your host, Nico McEwen.
Right now, we are speaking with Dr. David Hanscom. He is the author of Back in Control, and we've been talking a lot about expressive writing. The topic of the show today was supposed to be family, but I feel like we really we covered a pretty good summary of that, of how the way our attitude affects the people around us, especially the people who are closest to us, and vice versa. What do you suggest for people? Because when we're just starting out with trying to be mindful of not talking about our pain, not focusing so much on our anger, it's a process. It takes time. So do you encourage family members to call each other out on it? Or how does someone deal with it where they've read the book, they're doing all the stuff they're supposed to do, and yet they're still talking about their pain because maybe they're not conscious of it? How do you stop them?
Well, it's tricky, but I mean, it's an absolute. So I say, look, on a given couple, I say, look, so not only do I want you to not discuss your pain at home, but I want you to put up a 10-foot concrete wall, metaphorical concrete wall between you, that you actually have to emotionally release yourself from the other person's pain. In other words, people say, well, I have to know what's going on. I go, no, you don't. I says, you get to own your pain, and you get to own your pain. In other words, each person gets to own their own pain. End of story. The other person in the family is simply not responsible for the other person's pain. So it's not just a physical not discussing the pain. It's actually an emotional letting go. And paradoxically, as you start talking about good times, good food, good friends, etc., your brain starts to shift, the energy starts to shift, and things start to change rather quickly. So if my patient wants to participate in the project and the partner or spouse doesn't, that's their issue. In other words, you can't monitor the other person's progress because, again, you're getting connected to what they're doing, not owning it yourself. So as you know, when you're with your partner, the one thing that your partner can do for you is to be happy, right? Mm-hmm. And I also challenge my patients, say, look, you know, you're angry, you're taking it out on your family. Why would you want to do that? I mean, they're the people that you cherish. Why would you, I mean, you wouldn't walk up to a stranger and talk to them like you talk to your family. Why would you talk to your family like that? The other thing that's become rather increasingly clear and also very disturbing is that I had a patient a while back who was a big guy, and he'd been chronic pain for a while. And I asked him, well, who's the target of your anger? And it's usually, of course, the spouse or the partner. He goes, my son. I go, what do you mean your son? I go, how old's your son? He goes, 10. And I actually have to admit, I get a little bit upset. I said, look, you're the adult here. Your son's 10 years old. He says, you don't have the right to do that. This is against the rules of human conduct. You can't yell at your kids. So what also become clear is that family patterns get passed on to us that play out in our own families. But we also are programming our kids with the same behaviors that upset ourselves. So we're basically creating our own triggers in the form of our kids. So the children that we do anything for now become our triggers. And until you're aware of that, you end up teeing off verbally or physically on these people in your family that you love, and it makes no sense. It's really a danger. And as you know, with domestic violence now, the home is actually a very dangerous place. So instead of the home being a place of nurture, the metaphor I like to use is of a large oak tree, there's a head of the household. I want to be that oak tree with a big trunk, deep roots, a lot of shade to provide protection for my family. And kids thrive in the presence of feeling safe, loved, and nurtured. They don't nurture in the face, they don't thrive in the face of discipline, anger, arbitrary reactions, accomplishments, etc. They thrive when they feel safe. And right now, with, I'll just say, Americans pushing kids to accomplish this, do this, do this, do this, the parents are becoming more drill sergeants, and the home is not necessarily a place of safety anymore. So I think the number one responsibility as a parent is to create a place that's safe. And if your child is your trigger and you're yelling at them, that's not safe. Mm-hmm. So one of the instructions I give my parents is that, look, I want you to spend 1 month and not give one piece of advice to your child, not one. How do you think that goes over?
No way.
Right. But they do it. I mean, we go right after it. But the thing is, problem is, if I'm giving you advice, I'm really just projecting my view of the world onto you, which eventually becomes pretty tedious. In other words, I actually can't hear what you're trying to say because I'm so full of my own advice. And once you go into an awareness mode, life becomes incredibly more interesting because you're not projecting your view of reality onto everybody else.
I read that article on your blog about not giving advice for a month unless it's specifically asked for. And right. I've been facilitating this program called the Wellness Recovery Action Plan. And it's probably a little bit different with children because a parent's job is to guide the child to a certain degree. But we're actually taught in facilitator training not only not to give advice, but even if people are asking for advice, not to give advice, and to be mindful, the stronger the urge to give advice, the more likely it is that that advice is more for our own benefit rather than actually going to be helpful to the person.
Wow, I love it. That's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, I think that's dead on. That's really cool. What class is this? What are you doing?
It's called the Wellness Recovery Action Plan.
Okay.
Yeah.
And who are you working with?
I work with a couple of different organizations offering it, but it was developed by a woman in the States named Mary Ellen Copeland. And it was developed for people recovering from psychiatric issues, mm-hmm. but it's also been used for people recovering from pain, recovering from heart surgery, diabetes, a whole host of stuff.
Wow. That's fantastic. That's exactly dead on. But it's interesting how as parents we think we have the right to yell at our kids, and we actually don't. In mm-hmm. fact, why would you? I mean, we all do it, and I'm not guiltless here either. But I did read a book called Parent Effectiveness Training, which was written in the 1980s by a child psychiatrist by the name of Thomas Gordon. And I probably read the book at least 20 times, and it's about awareness. And his point is, parents will ask him, well, what if I need to guide my kid this way with wisdom, et cetera, et cetera? And my favorite part of the whole book is that how dare you be arrogant enough to the point of thinking that you're smarter than your kids, because you may not be. Mm. If you think you're smarter than your kid, then you've actually closed your door to true learning. And so it's a brilliant book of simply listening, interacting. He takes off the parent-child label. It's not about permissive parenting. It's about aware parenting. And it just completely changed my parenting paradigm with my son. But I do recommend it to all my patients. It's called Parent Effectiveness Training by Dr. Thomas Gordon. It is listed on my website as one of the core resource books. But yeah, when you make a commitment to create a safe house, in other words, this planet's a very competitive place, it doesn't really matter exactly how you do it, but if you make a commitment to bring creativity, love, and joy back into the house, as opposed to fighting anxiety and anger, I mean, you can create whatever you want. So once you understand that this whole process of anger and anxiety is a neurological trick, survival pattern that you can't fight, you quit fighting it, and then you start constructively every day working on creating something in your house that's good, it's just remarkable. I just can't put into words how powerful this has been the last 18 months. It's been unbelievable.
Awesome. I love that. So we have just a few minutes left in the show. We have been speaking with Dr. David Hanscom. He is the author of Back in Control, a Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. His website is backincontrol.com. There's lots of articles, blogs there, links to book recommendations as well. And again, the name of the book is Back in Control as well. So I'm wondering, David, what you'd like to focus on for the last few minutes of the show.
Well, I mean, I'd like to focus on the fact that, you know, chronic pain is considered uncurable. The medical profession is pretty much medicalized a neurological diagnosis. So it's become sort of a dangerous place to live right now as far as getting medical treatment. So we have this untreated chronic pain that's pervading every aspect of our society in forms of suicide, depression, mental health disorders, drug addiction. The opioid addiction process is driven by this. So the message is chronic pain is absolutely curable. Once you get the diagnosis made, why, it's not that hard to do. If we had the cure for cancer and heart disease, we'd be pretty excited about that, right? So chronic pain has a much bigger impact on society than those two diseases combined. When I give lectures around the country and ask how many physicians enjoy treating chronic pain, essentially nobody raises their hand. So we have a society that's suffering from anxiety, anger, and pain, and we're not adequately treating it. And that's why I'm really stopping my practice right now at the peak of my career to go public with this and say, look, this is a solvable problem, and please take responsibility for it. If you've had success with it, please pass it to somebody else. Because I think this is a major societal problem, and this battle is going to be only one, really just one person at a time. So yeah, I'm excited about it. I love treating chronic pain. It's the most, by far and away, to take somebody with no hope and watch them get their life back at a level that they never imagined. It's just been a very unexpected, rewarding experience for me.
Beautiful. Now, you mentioned, David, that you're giving up your spine surgery practice. So it sounds like, and you did mention this a little bit earlier, that studies are showing that spine surgery doesn't really help with the chronic pain.
Right.
Now, does that mean that everyone who gets a spine surgery is not going to be helped, or is it only people who are getting it specifically because of chronic pain rather than a structural abnormality?
So it doesn't matter where the pain starts, whether it's a structural problem or a soft tissue problem. Once the pain's been in your body for 3 to 6 months, your brain's memorized it. With the most classical example being a phantom limb pain, where somebody has an arm or leg amputated and they still feel the pain. So the brain simply memorizes the pain. So what happens, it doesn't really matter where it starts. And so right now the medical profession knows that lack of sleep, stress, depression, anxiety all affect surgical outcomes. So we find out if we address those factors systematically, people do very well with surgery when it's indicated. So first of all, surgery is indicated only when we can see the problem with matching symptoms. It's never indicated for pain by itself. Then even when you do surgery for a structural problem, if you don't address those factors that affect outcomes, the results can still be poor. So I do a fair amount of spine surgery, but it's very prepped. We do what's called rehab before surgery. And our surgical success rate has been almost probably 85-90% consistently now, which it didn't used to be that way.
David, I'm curious, how many patients do you get that walk in and you say, okay, well, before we even consider surgery, I want you to get your sleep in order. I want you to read this book, do this expressive writing, all of these, this whole protocol. How many of them say, well, I don't have any interest in this psychological mumbo jumbo. I'm going to go find a different surgeon.
A lot. And I just have to let go. I mean, I formally used to try to argue with them, say, look, I really want to help you out. I also point out, I said, look, you know, I get paid to do surgery whether you do well or not. Why would I do this? Why would I cut your surgical success rate in half or two thirds and just go ahead and do the surgery? I mean, I get paid the same, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of people get the surgery done. A lot of them do worse. Some do better. I mean, I wish them well. But I had to make a decision about 6 years ago that if somebody didn't want to do the prehab process and take responsibility for their own care, I wasn't their surgeon. So yeah, I lost a big part of my practice, and I still do.
Well, I really appreciate your willingness to step up in the face of what I imagine is a lot of pressure from the medical profession. Are you going to have to give up your medical license, or how does that work?
No, I mean, I have licenses in, you know, four states. So I'll still be doing consulting. I'm trying to, again, to me, this is a public health message. I've been asked to set up a spine center reflecting these type of concepts. But to me, my vision is bigger than that. I simply wanted to get the message out to the public, period, that, look, medicine's not helping you out right now. You can't help yourself out. But I'm really trying to flip the paradigm that patients are right now blindly trusting their doctors. But we're not trained correctly. I'm not trying to throw doctors under the bus, but we're not trained this way. If I hadn't gone through my own pain experience for so long, I would have no clue as to the nature of chronic pain. So right now, having procedures done randomly is dangerous. It's expensive. It's risky. So my vision is it's a massive, massive public health message. Mm.
Thank you so much for your time, David. We'll have to have you back on the show for another discussion and to see how things are going once you've walked away from your practice. So thank you again for the work that you're doing in the world. And thank you for listening. I really appreciate you tuning in. We have been speaking with Dr. David Hanscom. He is the author of Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. And you can find his blog and more information at backincontrol.com. Thank you again to David. Thank you for being with us. I want to send you so much love for a wonderful week. Be well. Namaste. Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
I know you're scared. Sometimes this world can be so blind, but if you take the chance to trust, start to open up, you just might find that you are loved. And I see the light in you shining with everything you do. Show me what you really want. Tell me what you really need. Reveal all you feel. You will be received. You don't have to hide away all the things you really want to say. There are others who have felt this way. You're not alone. I feel your pain. Yeah. And I see the light.
Would you like to get updates on your smartphone in an emergency, even if a cell tower is down? It is possible if the FM chip is activated in your phone. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You know what's better than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change.